From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
According to an assessment made public by the U.S. intelligence community in January, RT is the Kremlin's, and I quote, principal international propaganda outlet, end quote.
That was U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, on the floor of the Senate last week as she argued for a grant of additional powers to the Justice Department to investigate potential violations of the 1938 U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA. Shaheen has been particularly vocal about her claims that Russian media pose a major threat to U.S. national security, saying on more than one occasion that, quote, Russian propaganda has a body count, closed quote.
And it's integral to Russia's information warfare operations across the globe. The Kremlin selects the staff for RT and closely supervises RT's coverage, including disinformation and false news stories designed to undermine our democracy. If you have any question about that, watch RT here. It's on the cable network here in the D.C. area. RT News has publicly boasted that it can dodge our laws by claiming to be financed by a nonprofit organization and not by the Russian government. Well, recently, the Department of Justice asked RT America to, in fact, register as a foreign agent.
First passed in the lead-up to World War II to protect against German influence in the U.S., the act requires foreign governments, political parties, and lobbyists to register with the Department of Justice. Last week, the Justice Department required Russia's international news agency, RT, to register as agents of a foreign government, the only news agency required to do so as of RT's Monday filing. Under the act, RT will be required to disclose financial data and personal information of its employees. But such news agencies as the UK's BBC, Israel's I-24, and Saudi Arabia's Al Arabiya have not been required to register as foreign agents under FARA. Nevertheless, it appears that the censors in Congress are only just getting started. According to Reuters on Thursday, a report to the U.S. Congress released on Wednesday accused China state media entities of spying and propaganda and said their staff in the U.S. should be required to register as agents of a foreign government. The annual report was issued by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, created by Congress in the year 2000 to monitor the national security implications of U.S.-China trade relations. The report claims that China's state media expansion is part of a broad effort to exert greater control over how China is depicted globally, as well as to gather information. The report highlighted in particular Xinhua News Agency. It noted that Xinhua had offices at the UN in New York, in Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston, and San Francisco. The report claims that Xinhua, quote, serves some of the functions of an intelligence agency by gathering information and producing classified reports for the Chinese leadership on both domestic and international events, closed quote. It also cited testimony by U.S. government-funded Freedom House, calling the fact that individuals working for Xinhua and China's People's Daily newspaper were not covered by FARA a loophole. Russia, though, has held a special place in the heart of the U.S. government ever since the Bolshevik Revolution 100 years ago this month. That anniversary was recently noted by RT's self-styled bullhorns of propaganda on the channel's flagship program, Crosstalk. We spoke with one of those bullhorns, the only Russian among the group, Sputnik journalist Dmitry Babich, earlier this week via Skype from his office in Moscow. Dmitry, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
So I watched Crosstalk this week, looking at the Russian Revolution. An interesting conversation with you, Peter, Mark, and I forgot the gentleman's name from, I think he's from
Jeffrey Ottawa. Roberts.
Yes.
A historian from Ireland, but actually he's British, but he's teaching in Ireland now, yes.
Yes, an interesting, I mean, each one of you, different perspective, but out of all of them, you're the only one that's actually Russian. Mark is an American living in Russia, so is Peter, and we have a Brit living in Ireland. And the conversation was in English, airing for the benefit of audiences in the English-speaking world. I watched it here in New York. You were striking, each person had interesting things to say. You were striking on something towards the beginning, which is a point that we've sort of touched on also, and that I've heard you discuss at other times, and that is the similarities between the totalitarianism that has been at least imputed to and manifest some in the Soviet state.
Yes.
And the totalitarianism that exists in the United States today, or in the West today, and that being the definition of it, meaning essentially that a very small group of people hold the levers of government and economic and information power, military power, all of the levers of power in a very small set of hands.
Well, that's true, but not necessarily. Sometimes you have a greater number of people. What is important is that you have a very intolerant and a very aggressive ideology in power, which tries to monopolize its view on history. It tries to monopolize its view on family. So if you look at the first years of the Bolshevist Revolution, you will see a lot of similarities with the United States now. You'll see the destruction of monuments, which is guided by the idea that we can review history, we can do away with parts of the past that don't fit our narrative. Then you have fear of talking to foreigners, like in the United States, we have a new Russian ambassador in Washington, D.C. right now, and he can't meet a single U.S. congressman. They're all scared to death. You know, they're all unable to talk to him, not because he is scared, but because they're scared. That reminds me of the worst days of the Soviet Union. It reminds me of 1953, when Molotov's wife was imprisoned simply for talking to the Israeli ambassador. It reminds me of the times when the Russian, or rather the Soviet, diplomats abroad, they didn't call themselves ambassadors. They called themselves plenipotentiary representatives. Why? Because they thought that in a few years, all the world will be Soviet Union, all the world will be communist. So they didn't want to be called ambassadors. Well, if you look at the actions of, say, Michael McFaul in Russia when he was the American ambassador here, he behaved exactly like the Soviet ambassadors in the 20s. He basically viewed himself as a person who can start revolutions here, who can teach people how they can improve democracy here, not even improve, how they can topple the government and get a better system, you know. He was not afraid and he was not ashamed of basically lecturing Russians on the right way to get rid of their government. So there are so many similarities. And I would say that these similarities are mostly the negative ones. There was a lot of positive things about the Soviet Union, including the early Soviet Union, which are not to be seen in the United States right now. You know, the idea that people should have equal access to education, that education should be free, that basic health services should be free, all of that is absolutely absent in the United States now. So the United States has a lot of similarities with the early Soviet Union, but mostly the most negative things. The lack of freedom, I would say, is for everyone to see.
Yeah, the at the time that, post-revolutionary Russia, I'm focusing on at the moment, you had a condition where, there was war. The Bolsheviks came to power because they said, enough war. They promised peace, bread, and land, essentially. And that won the hearts of workers, people in the military, and peasants. And they delivered those things, although there were political struggles. On the one hand, there was the model that developed there. We have seen in other places, however, where that model was not developed, what happened to those regimes? I'm thinking, for example, anywhere from Mossadegh to Chile in 1970s, you know, a number of other places where even moderate socialist governments were treated ruthlessly by the United States and crushed, in some very ugly periods of actual overt fascism in places like Chile, for example, or in Iran, or what followed. What kinds of possibilities, this is, of course, just speculating, but what kinds of things could have happened, do you think, that where, say, the path away from the one that was followed might have been pursued, yet delivering the good things that were delivered, such as free education, health care, you know, defeating fascism, by the way, things like that?
Well, I mean, you probably remember the image that I used during our conversation. I said that the Russian Revolution reminds me of an elephant in a dark room,
yes,
touched by three blind philosophers. You know, one of them touches the leg and says, oh, an elephant is something like a column, right?
Right, right.
The other one touches the trunk and says, oh, no, this is something much more flexible.
Right.
Then the third one touches the tail and says, no, you are both wrong. The elephant is something like a rope.
Right.
So, I mean, if you look at the Russian Revolution, and of course, there was a certain unity between February, when basically a liberal provisional government came to power, toppling the Tsar. It was done with the help of the military, who actually had a conspiracy against the Tsar. And without February, October would not be possible,
right,
you know,
that's
with
correct.
A yep. radical leftist party coming to power in Russia. So, again, coming back to that metaphor of an elephant, of course, there are many people in Russia, including President Putin, who view and who see primarily the negative side of the revolution. I mean, if you... If you're just a grown-up person living in 1917, you know, the fall in the standard of living was dramatic. Already in 1918, people lived several times worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were coming off 4 years of war or something at that point in time, a very destructive war and all kinds of other problems that predated the revolution.
So if you want to look at the revolution from the point of view of tragedy, you know, which it was for millions of people, then it's very easy to find facts. You know, there was a dramatic fall in the standard of living. The normal exchange between the village and the city was destroyed in 1918 for a number of reasons.
Right.
And it was not actually the Bolsheviks who did all the destruction. You know, the Tsar started it because in 1916, in order to win the war, Russia sort of remade its industry to serve the military purposes. So the peasants didn't get their usual share of industrial goods, you know, to exchange for agricultural products.
Right.
That happened back in 1916, even before the Tsar was toppled. So something terrible was going to happen. There was going to be disruption. There were going to be confiscations if the cities were to survive. But, of course, the revolution made it a lot more painful, a lot more dramatic. So that was the negative side. The positive side, well, I mean, it was indeed the first country in Europe and in the world which proclaimed that everyone has the right to free education, and the education was free.
Yep.
I mean, it was not ideal. A lot of it, of course, a lot of fighting against illiteracy started back in the times of the Tsar. I mean, the number of literate people in Russia was growing rapidly in what the mathematicians would call a geometrical progression starting from 1890s. But it was the communists, the leftists, who brought it all to the glorious end in the 20s and 30s. Mm. Again, the other question is, did the Bolsheviks, by coming to power, did they scare the German bourgeoisie so that the German bourgeoisie would choose Hitler and his so-called National Socialists as the new government of Germany? Yes. The Bolsheviks did scare the German the German bourgeoisie. On the other hand, would Russia be capable of defeating Hitler and his Nazis with the people like Kerensky and his liberal provisional government, you know, ruling Russia? Right. No way.
Right.
So you have a situation where for every yes you have a no.
Yeah.
And this is the problem because the revolution is still a very passionate subject in Russia.
Of course.
And when you start talking to an average person, immediately you see either a radical on one side saying that the revolution was bad from A to Z, or you have the opposite view, like it was good from A to Z. No, the revolution was like an elephant, as I told you. And if we look at it, we have to look at it as a whole. We should not be like one of these blind philosophers just touching the tail or touching the leg. If you look at the general result, I would say that the revolution did more. It did more for the countries of post-war Europe, for countries like Norway, Sweden, even France or Germany. It did more for them than it did for the Russian people, because the Russian people had to go through the bad side of the experiment. The moderate governments in the post-war years, they took all the good, they took all the good lessons. Now, unfortunately, the situation is different. We see another aggressive, monopolistic, totalitarian ideology coming to power in the United States and in the European Union, showing all the bad sides of Bolshevism without any of its good sides, capable of aligning with itself with Nazism, especially in places like Ukraine, in places like Croatia, capable of aligning itself with radical religious fanaticism, like the West, in fact, allied itself with Sunni radicals in Syria.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the Soviet Union, there was only one instance when there was a kind of a temporary truce between the Soviet Union and the Nazi forces. That was in the immediate aftermath of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Well, in the West now, we see an alliance with Ukrainian Nazis, with Croatian Nazis, with the Baltic Nazis, with Libyan and Syrian radical Sunni Islamists. We've seen it continuing for years, probably for decades.
Yeah.
So if you ask me who was worse, communism or the current ultra-liberalism, I'm at pains to answer. Nazism was certainly worse than the other two.
Yeah, right,
but
for sure.
the problem is that Stalin in 1939 and modern West, especially in the last 20 years, they have shown themselves of being capable even of aligning themselves with Nazis temporarily.
Well, okay, so just to follow the logic of the argument that, or looking at the flip side, really, of the argument that Bolshevik Revolution produced benefits in the West by holding up examples of free healthcare, free education, universal suffrage, you know, many things like that. That these were basically induced in the Western countries where the bourgeoisie was looking at the Soviet Union saying, oh my God, if we don't make some concessions to our workers, they're going to go that way and string us up like the Romanovs. And the flip side of that is now that we have this, a situation existing in the West, are there benefits being induced in, say, Russia and China by the developments in the United States, or the development in particular of this ideological, monstrosity?
Well, maybe in an indirect way, because, if the European Union and the United States did not act so aggressively against Russia in Ukraine, in the former Yugoslavia, in Syria, in Georgia, probably Vladimir Putin would not have been so different from Boris Yeltsin. Because in the 90s, the Russian elite felt like we're going to have prosperity for ourselves forever. We're going to sell oil and gas to the European Union. The European Union is our privileged partner, preferably the only one. And I remember Putin's early years in power. That was not very different from his actions, at least in the beginning. There was one major difference from Yeltsin. Putin realized that Russia could not afford an agreement or an appeasement of terrorists in Chechnya, especially those connected to Saudi Arabia. So he acted much more decisively there, and we now have peace there. But economically, I mean, if you look at the first years of Putin in power, he continued the same policy of basically gearing the Russian economy to the European Union. He made lots of concessions in order to join the WTO. And now, obviously, there's a lot of questions about WTO. Do we really need it if WTO does not prevent the European Union and the United States from imposing sanctions on us? According to WTO rules, you can only impose sanctions if there is a decision by the Security Council of the United Nations. So, right. from the purely legal point of view, almost all of the American sanctions, except maybe the ones they imposed on the North Korean regime, they're all illegal. Right. So, in a way, I think the monstrous ultra-liberal or neoliberal ideology, which is now reigning in the United States and in the EU, by antagonizing the Russian elite, by antagonizing, to a lesser extent, the Chinese elite, I think it made these elites do more for their peoples. It's a bizarre situation, but that is how history develops. Yeah. Whenever you have an impression that one ideology is going to sweep the world, never to be replaced, immediately you have more exploitation. Immediately you have a monopoly of rich people on the media. Immediately you have a hysteria of making everything as I want in a second. You know, you have all of these hysterical changes, like I want everything to be .com tomorrow, I want everything to be blockchain tomorrow. You know, without the conflicts, the periodical conflicts between the predators, I don't think people would survive in general.
That's interesting. Periodic conflicts between predators. You're talking about the clashing interests of separate elites.
That's exactly true. So in a way, I think in Europe, in the post-war years, they introduced all these social reforms, not just because they imitated the good experiences of the Soviet Union. Not all of these experiences were very successful. They were just afraid that leftists would come to power in a legal way.
Right.
It was very possible in the countries like Italy, France, even in places like Spain, you know, it was possible when Franco was toppled in 1974. In the immediate aftermath of Franco's fall, it was it looked possible that leftists would come to power, as they did in some countries of Latin America.
You know, the United States has had a long history of regime change and then taking the subject nations, turning them essentially into storehouses for raw materials and surplus labor. I'm speaking here in particular of the Monroe Doctrine, where the Western Hemisphere was made available to American capital from the beginning of the 19th century. And we've seen that model developing across the world, where the U.S. supplanted the older colonial powers like Spain, France in the 19th century, Spain at the end of the 19th century, and those that were left after the two world wars. But we also have seen a similar situation, really, with respect to the West towards the Soviet Union, the former republics, including Russia, which is kind of the context in which Yeltsin came to power, and particularly the result was that the elite, as he described it, was perfectly happy there to let Russia be, you know, an oil well for the people of Western Europe and a bank for themselves. This has changed some. And what we're seeing across the, like the BRICS, regional groupings like CELAC, for example, or the SCO and others, are large chunks of the global economy busting away from this economic construct and political economy. Does Russia have a role? Right now, Russia's playing a role as a guarantor of the sovereignty of particularly itself and China with its strategic weaponry. And it also has a considerable technological base that it offers to the newly assembling economic structure. But is there a real, like, a central political and role for Russia in this rising multipolarity?
Well, I think that actually Russia did not have any cunning plans on surviving in this new world. The Trump of Russia, if you want, I'm sorry for the pun here, but the real Trump of Russia is the stupidity and the absurdity of the modern West. I don't want to say that all the people living in the United States or in Western Europe are stupid,
right,
but the ideology which is prevailing in Western Europe and in the United States is extremely stupid.
Yes.
It certainly did not learn anything from 1917. The problem is that this ideology demonizes 1917, but it considers 1917 a lesson only to Russians,
right,
not even to Ukrainians or the Latvians or the Georgians, people who lived in the former Soviet Union. And coming back to your question, what lies ahead and why are we in this situation? Well, I would say that Russia is now groping for the way forward. I think the main crisis is already behind us, because I think the most difficult decisions were taken in 2014, you know, after the Maidan coup in Ukraine. Then Putin had to face a choice. Either we acquire to ultra-liberalism, or we act. And he chose to act. Lots of people said, you will be dead next minute. We are not dead.
Right.
We were successful in Syria. We survived, and we continue to survive the sanctions. The Ukrainian regime is a terrible failure of the West. So basically, what we see is that you can resist ultra-liberalism. It is not invincible. This is the main lesson of the last 3 years. For the first time since the late 80s, when it started its expansion, ultra-liberalism suffered several defeats. It suffered a defeat in Syria. It suffered a defeat in Crimea. It suffered a defeat now with North Korea. It is in the process of suffering that defeat. And these are all very reassuring developments. The question is, will our elite have the courage to continue, or will they try to go back? I hope they realize that there is simply no way back.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.